Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Michael McCauley. Michael McCauley teaches writing at Northwestern University. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Sun Ascent, and other journals. His book is forthcoming this winter from Soft Skull Press. He'll be reading from that book tonight, which is titled After Death Room, Journeys into Spiritual Activism. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi, Ellen. Thanks for having me.
How about we start out tonight with you maybe setting up a scene and reading a little bit for us?
Sure. The section I'm going to read has to do with Chicago. And in my book, I have traveled from South Africa to India, Thailand, Vietnam, and then Chicago, where I live, and then finally in Senegal, trying to give a sort of an overview of the AIDS pandemic. And in this particular section, which comes towards the end of the book, the Chicago section, I'm visiting Cook County Jail, which is one of the largest jails in the United States. So I'll just get started here.
Great.
It's a sunny winter day, warm even, as I drive through Chicago's West Side neighborhood to get to 26th and California, the euphemism for Chicago's criminal justice complex. The criminal court building is said to process more cases than any other court in the world, and next to it, Cook County Jail, one of the largest jails, if not the largest in the United States, spreading out over nearly 100 acres, 11 brick multi-story blocks on any given day houses 10,000 inmates, most of whom are young, poor, and black or Latino. Majority of them are here because they were caught doing things that are related to drugs, getting them, using them, selling them, stealing, or killing for them. Over 100,000 inmates a year pass through Cook County on their way to court, back onto the street, or to one of Illinois' fastest growing businesses, its state and federal prisons. Nearly 2 million men and women are incarcerated in America's jails and prisons, thanks to the stiffening of sentences related to drug possession and trafficking in the 80s. Some 40% of that staggering number are black. If you consider the numbers who are on probation or on parole, the numbers of men and women under custody or surveillance in the United States is close to 6 million people, over 2% of the population. By comparison, in most European countries, the number of incarcerated citizens is 8 times lower. Steel spirals of razor fencing reflect blinding sunlight as I enter into a side door of Cermak Health Center, which is a part of Cook County Jail. There I am to meet Dr. James Kirby Cunningham, a veteran physician who has been serving Chicago's marginalized communities infected with HIV for going on 2 decades. For the past 3 years, Cunningham has been coming to the jail twice a week in a new program designed to address what most prisons have neglected, the precipitous rise in HIV infection rates for men and now for women. Estimates put the numbers of infected at Cook County somewhere between 4 and 5%, which means that the number of infected is twice the 200 and some known cases in the jail. After going through a series of locked gates, a doctor's assistant, who also happens to be a priest, introduces himself and leads me down an elevator and through a tunnel into what feels more like a bomb shelter than a hospital. Here among Hulk-like prison guards, the priest introduces me to Cunningham as he comes out of a little cubicle. In hiking boots and wearing khakis and a rumpled shirt with rolled-up sleeves, Cunningham asks me in a warm Texas drawl if it's okay if he can talk to me between seeing his patients. They run me ragged around here, he tells me, which is no joke, as he has to hike through the maze of Cook County's tunnels that link the 11 buildings to make his rounds. At 9 sharp, I can hear some commotion out in a large holding area outside his cubicle, and in comes his first patient. He explains to him that I'm here to write about the jail. The 30-something Latino man shrugs, barely noticing me. He holds his jaw, telling the doctor that he's got a toothache. He also complains that his methadone treatment is too high. They go over his numbers. His T-cells are high. The T-cells are the amount of not the virus, but it sort of describes the level of the immune system. So his immune system was low. He doesn't seem concerned much about his HIV infection. What he wants from the doctor is to see if he can get off his floor. They're just a bunch of gangbangers. I want to get out of there. He wants a painkiller, but Cunningham pointedly tells him he doesn't have any. The man is in for armed robbery. Cunningham suggests that when he gets out, he should consider a treatment program. The next man who enters reminds me of the infected men I saw in my travels in Asia. Ghostly and thin, his shoulders hunch even though he is a tall man of only about 30. A new inmate. He is in for possession. He's been off his meds for a year, and when he comes back, he started again. Apparently a common theme. Cunningham tells me that many of the men only get treatment when they are incarcerated. His viral load, the amount of virus found in his blood, is high, but coming down now that he is back on medication. The doctor pleads with him to keep taking meds. Why weren't you taking them? Cunningham says. Why didn't you come in to see us at CORE? The CORE is the CORE Center. It's a state-of-the-art service center in Chicago where Cunningham sees former inmates once a week. Cunningham asks him a series of questions bluntly and quickly. Do you drink? Do you take drugs? Have you had sex with men? Like all the prisoners, he wears a shabby yellow-brown uniform with missing buttons and frayed cuffs. I'd be tired all the time. I'm trying to stay away from drugs, but I smoke weed, see, because it helps me with my appetite, he tells Cunningham, and now turning to me, noticing that I'm writing down what he has said. I can't sleep. I've lost 18 pounds. Can't feel anything in my feet. I'd be glad if you wrote about me. Then maybe it would help somebody. You can't expect me to rescue you, Cunningham says. You've got to take care of yourself. Cunningham pleads, striking a tone that reveals his years of experience with a variety of folk who contract HIV. Like so many physicians and healthcare professionals who work with the incarcerated, half of his job is that of a therapist, parent, and job counselor. I'm impressed as he goes from ethnicity to ethnicity, shifting slightly his rhetoric. He must sift through layers of truth to find the right words to keep these men directed toward a healthier future. Yet he is aware that he is often the only one who listens to problems he can't really do much about. They want off floors, more blankets, blocks that have warm showers. One young man in his early 20s spends half his time during the visit pacing, leaning over Cunningham's shoulder as he writes, pleading, whining, desperate for attention. It's painful to watch a young man with so much energy, so much need. I'm gonna die up there, Doc, he says. You gotta get me out of there. There's no heat, no hot water. A person with HIV can't stand this stuff. What are you in for? The doctor asks. Possession and burglary, 6 to 30 years. I wind up back to drugs. You love me, Dr. Cunningham. You gotta help me. You gotta. He pulls up his shirt. I got a bullet in me, see? He turns to show me. A scar pinches and discolors a section of skin on his back. I can't be treated like this. Cunningham says he'll try to help, but reminds him to see the health educator on his ward. Who's that? What educator? I never seen that guy. Cunningham writes him a slip for an extra mattress and pillows and a lower bunk. When the young man leaves, Cunningham sighs. It's a never-ending cycle in here. They don't have anything out there. The real work, he says, is to get the government to decriminalize drug use and change the sentencing laws. Or at least the city or state should provide more than the minuscule number of treatment programs they can give to the thousands of men and women who are clearly suffering from drug addiction. Cook County's criminal justice system apparently has only enough money to offer 50 convicted drug offenders the standard detox program. From his vantage point, stiffer sentencing has done nothing to deter drug use or its sale. If anything, it has made thousands of young men wards of the state and more embittered, hardened criminals who return to neighborhoods where they cause themselves and those around them more harm. And in the case of those men with HIV, the harm to others is literally poisoning families and whole communities.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Michael McCauley, reading from his forthcoming book, After Death Room, Journeys into Spiritual Activism. So, Michael, you know, I know that scene goes on a little bit, and,
right.
you know, I think it's one of the things that's important. I mean, there's lots of important things about your book, but one of it is, one of the points is how it educates people about things we just don't know.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, because the next thing that happens was really surprising to me.
Right. I mean, being at Cook County was, I'd never been in a prison before going there, and... one of the things that I discovered was that several men are given drugs and tested for being HIV positive, and sometimes the doctors are changing, and sometimes the paperwork gets lost. And one man actually complained about the drug use, the drugs that he was receiving, and then we find out that he'd been misdiagnosed, and for 6 months he was taking HIV drugs and he wasn't HIV positive. And so, I mean, things like that happen, and I felt really bad for the doctor, and he basically said, well, there's so much I can't do here, and it's just a tip of the iceberg about the numbers of people that are so poorly treated in America's prison system. And the upshot is that these people go back into society, and particularly with HIV and other STDs, they're infecting other people. And mm-hmm. in my view, in some ways, this is, you know, willful neglect of a whole group of population. But as far as public health, it's really stupid policy.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the title of the book? Because I think... you know, one, the story of the title,
right?
But then also the spiritual activism,
right? Yeah.
the title comes from.
Well, the title comes from a place in the book in northern Thailand, where I spent about 7 weeks in Thailand, and there is a AIDS. They call him the AIDS monk, and he is a monk who has a monastery in north of Bangkok. And really, since the beginning of the outbreak in Thailand in the early 90s, he took it upon himself to open a hospice at the monastery. And many people have used this hospice because there were no facilities. Particularly for poorer people who didn't have the money to go to hospitals and things like that. So he took AIDS patients and treated them. And at that time, there was no drugs. There are drugs now in Thailand for some people. And they drop them off there. Many people drop their relatives off in the middle of the night because of stigma and shame. And of course, this monk took them in and took them into this clinic. And most of the people that were dropped off died there. So... In the monastery, there is a room called the after death room, and in it is several bodies on display who are, you know, people who have died of AIDS. Four are floating in formaldehyde, and there's four more who are mummified. And there are people who are sex workers, and they've used drugs, and supposedly they donated their bodies so that other people can come and see them, and in some ways be shocked, because the Buddhist tradition is to shock people into the reality of their life and making changes, and knowing that their bodies are just part of the earth, and that they will go away, but the spiritual body remains, and it's in a way to kind of make people pay attention to the reality of death, and that it will come eventually, and to take care of the true self rather than just the body. So they're there to sort of scare people, but at the same time to illustrate right. the Buddhist tradition.
And that, I mean, obviously had to have been an shocking experience for you.
Yeah, indeed. I was very angry to see it, being HIV, and I was really concerned because I thought that the people had been sort of misused, and I thought it was a sacrilege to have their bodies that way. But I think over time, because I met another Buddhist monk who kind of explained to me why that was used the way it was, and I became a little less troubled. But I'm still ambiguous about mm-hmm. it. I mean, these people were poor people. They were sex workers. And, you know, the morality that people who have control and power, whether they're Buddhist monks or they're Christian ministers or their government officials, wherever in the world, there's still this disconnect between people who are in position to contract HIV and those who have the drugs and the wherewithal and the money to, you know, not be infected, because a lot of the people in the world who are infected with HIV are mostly poor people,
yeah,
or marginalized people.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Michael McCauley, reading from his forthcoming book, After Death Room, Journeys into Spiritual Activism. I want to give people a sense of the scope,
sure,
of the book, because
right,
it's got a broad scope. And then,
yeah,
I guess as we're talking about that, I'm curious as to how you put a frame around it. Like, because one, could you talk about the various countries,
right,
that
yeah,
you cover? And then it's also a story about your life.
Yeah, it's definitely, yeah. I went to South Africa to the AIDS conference there in the year 2000. I was invited there to do a workshop on the benefits of yoga for people living with HIV. I'm HIV positive, and I have used yoga as a not only a spiritual practice, but a way in which I can have an active role in my own health.
Mm-hmm.
And I did some workshops in Chicago, and then I wanted to go to South Africa. And there, I was really galvanized to do more than just offer these little yoga workshops, because I met a lot of activists, not only from South Africa, but around the world, because the AIDS conference brings together not only doctors and health officials, but lots of social workers and AIDS activists from everywhere. And they really impressed me, their intensity. And many of them were people who were HIV positive themselves. And so their activism was a form of dealing with their health issues and dealing with their own sadness and suffering. And I just was so impressed with their power and their openness, and the fact that they felt like their work was not only helping themselves but their communities. And so from there, I felt, you know, compelled to do something as a writer. I wanted, and somebody who's HIV positive, I wanted to sort of involve myself more. And I had always neglected the activism in America. I'd never gotten involved. I never went the walks or the runs, or, you know, I just had been outside of that. And so I decided to go to India, and because I knew that India was dealing with the AIDS epidemic and it was exploding there. And because I'd practiced yoga and went to India to study yoga, I thought, well, I'll go there and then Asia and maybe back to Africa and sort of chronicle how these different activists around the world are doing the work that they're doing, which in my view has been sort of neglected, you know, the story of the AIDS activist. And so I, you know, like I say, I started to go to these different countries and interview these activists.
Great. How about you read another section from,
sure,
the book?
Okay, this section is actually from Senegal, and it's sort of the latter part of the book. And I was in the Peace Corps in Senegal in the early 80s. As a matter of fact, that's where I first heard the BBC newscast in 1981. That sort of opened the era of AIDS, and so I went back to this village to see these people, and before I got to the village, I went to a town called Kaolack, was taken there by a social worker and into a community of sex workers there. And so this is a scene of meeting these sex workers in this area outside the city of Kaolack. We head through the old part of the city near the Saloum River by the market and then turn, and I know exactly where we are. It's the road south that leads to my village. Abdullahi, he's one of the social workers, tells the driver to stop, and we get out in the middle of the chaos that is the outdoor taxi station where I used to board the bush taxis that took me the 45 minutes to my village. Behind me is where I used to buy oranges and cola nuts for the villagers. Across the street is where the women sat who sold the sugary cafe au lait and the mysterious medicinal kinkiliba tea. There are still the corpulent Wolof women there who served cheap meals from smoldering iron pots. Teams of grimy teenagers covered in tattered oil-stained clothes pound away on pieces of Japanese and French cars of another era. hoping to turn a few scraps into salvage for their boss. The deafening din of the station with its taxis and buses honking and boys shouting for passengers creates a mixture of nausea and fear. I walk by these young men who sleep in the oily sand where they work, living no better than dogs that slink about the market, and I ask myself, had it been like this before and I never noticed? Was I that naive? The sex workers live in the squatters' camp on the salt flats of the Saloum River across from the taxi station. They and the rest of the squatters must contend not only with the rising waters and mud in the rainy season, but with the stench from the trash and human waste, as the outside of any village or city is basically an open sewer. I look beyond the huts, and as far as the eye can see, there are blue plastic bags dotting the landscape. Thousands and thousands everywhere. In my day, the shopkeepers used old French newspapers, or some even used leaves to wrap things, but now, like plastic bottles, they litter the countryside. Further across the river, I spot the familiar two mountains of salt and their shadow, a black tanker docked at the salt processing plant. The sex workers, or as the Senegalese refer to them, gencats, literally the women who work outside, live in a compound of primitively made huts with thatch roofs and corrugated doors not unlike those I remember from my own village. The skinny public health worker leads the way, greeting the women and the poor families that live around them. Feces and condoms are everywhere. He enters a hut and motions with his ever-present cigarette to wait. When he emerges, he beckons with a smile, whispering to Abdullah that they will expect payment for their time. We pull back a ragged sheet hanging from the door frame, and on a bed sit two women, one in her late 20s, another over twice her age. The elder, who seems in charge, has a round copper face. She wears a slip over her drooping breasts and a wraparound piece of cloth for a skirt. Her skin is worn and wrinkled, her face etched in a permanent long frown. Abdullah greets them, explaining who we are and why we have come. She solemnly invites us to sit on one of the two double beds, which are as hard as rock, as the mattresses are burlap bags sewn together and filled with old straw. Two more women enter shyly, one with a baby. Their bodies sag, their shoulders and heads droop. It's late afternoon. They will start working soon, working sometimes all night. The elder woman does the talking. She says they are not proud to do this, but they have no choice. They can make a thousand francs per trick, a little more than a dollar, though often it is less. Then a small older woman, who must be over 60, comes in with a baby too. The woman whose hut we are in pulls a box from under her bed. She won't take a man unless he uses one, she tells us sternly. Not even if he gives me 5,000, she states proudly. Wow, wow, which means yes, yes, and Wolof. The others chime in, nodding. Animated, she now pulls out a chart from behind her bed. A picture graph shows how to put on a condom. As she explains, she rips open one of the condoms from what must be 100 of them in a box under her bed and puts fingers through one, demonstrating. Abdullah leans over and tells me she regularly gives a demonstration at a clinic for women. Through the back door, I see a woman stripped to the waist, pouring water from a cup onto her arms and chest, washing herself as the sun drops lower in the sky. I whisper to Abdu. Abdu is my guide and translator, who's different than Abdullah, just to make everyone clear. I whisper to Abdu, who whispers to Abdullah, who tells the elder woman that I'd like to hear some of the other women's stories. They confer, and the younger woman, who had been there from the start, drops her head, straightens her skirt, and begins to speak. Behind terribly sad eyes, she appears to be losing the battle to maintain her dignity and health. As she talks, she holds back tears, pulling them in by puckering her face and staring hard at me. She tells us she has two children, and her voice breaks. When her husband died, she came to visit relatives in Cowlack and with no other support decided to stay, leaving her children with her family. She doesn't tell them where she gets the money that she brings back on her monthly visits. Describing how hard her work is, she pounds the bed to remind us that they must lie every night with men on top of them, and as she pounds, a cloud of dust and flies lift from the threadbare bedsheet. You hurt. You are sore. She points to her neck and back. Abdu and Abdullah are gripped by her testimony. Do they know anyone who has SIDA? SIDA is the French version of AIDS. I ask without Abdu's help. They shake their heads solemnly. Are they worried about it? The room is suddenly quiet. They nod, looking at me, and then away. I want to hear from the four others sitting there, but Abdu and Abdullah both look eager to get going. We get up together. I tell them in my Wolof that I am grateful, and both men relay the same more eloquently. I fish around for the money I have promised to give to them, 1,000 francs for each one, and hand it to Abdullah, who gives it to the older woman to disperse. The exchange is awkward. The women nod their goodbyes while eyeing the money. I wasn't going to reveal my status, but suddenly I feel that I must. I want them to know that I didn't just come here as a journalist, as an American with 1,000 CFA notes to hand out. My mouth begins to speak almost before I can think of what to say. I turn to them and plead in English, protect yourself, be careful, our bodies are sacred. My legs begin to shake as I hear Abdu's translation, knowing what I want to say, but not sure how to say it in Wolof. Parska Sida, Amna Sida, I finally spit out, pointing to myself with my thumb. Wow, wow, man, Amna, Amna. Yes, me, I have it, I tell them. They are confused, looking at me, and then back at Abdu and Abdullah for help. But then, as Abdu explains and Abdullah reinforces, they get it. The white man has SIDA. All at once, there is a clamor of responses, as if by admitting my status, I am no longer the white man with the pen and paper. I've become the very thing that we have been discussing. I am SIDA. I am AIDS. Dimbli Nanu, help us, help us, they plead. A woman pleads, holding my hand. We don't want to get SIDA too. We don't want to do this. We want, if we had money, if we had other work. They huddle around me, pushing back, Abdu and Abdullah patting me on my arms with their hands, instinctively wanting to touch me. As is Wolof custom, upon learning of sad news, they offer me their pity. Inde san, which means we pity you, and evoke Allah to protect me from death. The public health official leads us away, smiling and joking at the looks on our faces, offering some expression in French that I don't get as I try to keep from stepping on trash and tripping on my emotions.
Michael McCauley reading from After Death Room, Journeys into Spiritual Activism, coming out shortly from Soft Skull Press. Thanks for coming to Prosody, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Ellen.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineer is Joseph Wilk, with special thanks this week to Daryl Jones and Electric Mayhem Studios in Chicago. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.